We have a full day of presentations again today. And to lead with our first presentation today is ProAssurance. They have presented and attended the conference for a number of years now. And pulling from Hallmark's presentation yesterday, ProAssurance on a 15-year total return basis was top 10. It was at number 8 of all publicly traded insurance stocks. On a 10-year total return basis, it was number 11. And on a 5-year total return basis, it was ranked number 7. This is out of a pool of almost 100 publicly traded companies. So obviously they've been very successful in the medical malpractice space. I'm very pleased to have Stan Starnzel, the chairman and CEO, Ned Rand, and Frank O'Neill with us today. And to lead off the story, I'm going to turn it over to Ned.
Thanks, Greg, and good morning, everybody. I'm just going to kind of set the stage for Stan's comments, talk a little bit about the financial position of ProAssurance, where we are today. We've not yet released year-end numbers, so the data we're looking at is going to be through the end of the third quarter. Really, through the last 18 months, our focus, probably more so than ever, has been on our balance sheet. We certainly pay attention to earnings and to top-line growth and metrics such as that, but the real focus has been on our balance sheet. And what you see before you is just the last, basically, 4 years of our balance sheet and the growth that we've seen. We ended the third quarter with over $1.5 billion in shareholders' equity and about $4.5 billion in assets, about $4 billion of which are investments. And that's really probably one of the keys to our balance sheet is that investment portfolio. As I said, just under $4 billion and really largely fixed income, 90% fixed income, 4% short-term. The BOLI, business-owned life insurance, is essentially a fixed income product as well. So very conservative portfolio, and we manage it as a very conservative portfolio given the risk we take on the liability side of our balance sheet. We take a lot of risk on the liability side given the nature of the business that we write. We write a line of business that has historically been extremely volatile, so we tend not to take a tremendous amount of risk on the asset side. The duration of our portfolio is just over 4 years. You add cash into that, and it takes it to just under 4 years, 97% investment grade, and a significant component in municipal bonds given our tax status. Investments and investment income are always an important part of a long-tailed line of business such as ours. But in today's interest rate environment, the underwriting side of the equation becomes even more important. When interest rates are at 5 or 6%, you can write to well over a 100 combined ratio and still meet, at least for us, what our ROE objective is for the business, which is a 13% ROE. When we get down to these low interest rate environment that we're in today, the discipline underwriting is really mandatory. That's what this chart seeks to show, that you cannot write to those high combined ratios that the industry has historically written to. The life of a claim for professional medical liability from kind of inception of event to settlement of that claim can take up to 8 or 10 years. Probably most of them settle within that 5 to 6 year period, but there is a long time between the collection of a premium dollar and the ultimate payment of a claim, which does allow us to lever the money we receive. Investment income is a critical component of our operations, just more challenging today. As interest rates come up, you'll see the environment get more competitive from an underwriting standpoint, but we can sustain that given the fact that we hold cash for the length of time that we do. We're in a unique position right now that we're very well capitalized. And one of the metrics that we monitor, we measure, that's very important for us, is growth in book value per share. It's probably the most important metric for us as a management team. The chart here just shows that growth over time. But we are very well capitalized right now. We have very little debt on our balance sheet, a debt-to-cap ratio of about 3%. Over the last several years, we've paid down some debt. We've also been buying back our stock. Over the last 2.5 years, I guess, we've bought back over $200 million of our stock. But in spite of that, we are somewhat overcapitalized. In an optimal situation, we would write a dollar of premium for every dollar of capital that we hold. And as you can see right now, we're at about a 0.3-to-1 ratio. So plenty of capacity to write additional business. Oftentimes when we begin to talk about that, the question comes up, well, does that then identify your excess capital? And there is a difference between excess capacity and excess capital, and I think it's important that people understand that. The addition of a dollar of premium to all of the different risk-based capital models that we follow, they're the ones that the regulators use, the ones the rating agencies use, our own internal metrics. The addition of a dollar of premium has a very different effect than taking a dollar of capital away, and that's what the two lines on this graph show. The green line shows the incremental change of adding a dollar of premium. The blue line shows the incremental impact of taking away a dollar of capital. So the difference between excess capacity and excess capital are very distinct, and I think important that people understand that. I'm sorry, that is the threshold, is just the threshold of maintaining a theoretical AM best rating of A. And going out this side, I honestly cannot remember. It goes up several hundred million dollars. Just a quick snapshot of our income statement. I said we focus on the balance sheet, but obviously we're very mindful of the income statement as well. Through the first 9 months, operating income per share, $4.08 compared to $3.73 per share last year. We will be releasing earnings, Frank, on the 24th. And we'll have updated numbers available at that time. With that, I'll turn things over to Sam.
Thank you, Ned. Good morning. The financial picture that Ned has just shared with you demonstrates to you why ProAssurance enjoys a best rating of A, why ProAssurance for the last 3 years has been selected as one of the Ward's top 50 for the last three consecutive years in the United States. And the numbers are important and the numbers are meaningful. But I want to depart from the slides for just a moment, which Frank won't particularly like, but leave the slides alone and tell you something about what's really at the core of ProAssurance and what we think distinguishes us and differentiates us in the marketplace. To know who we are and where we're going, it's important to know our history and where we come from. And I want you in your mind's eye to go back to 1975, and you're a physician practicing medicine in Alabama. You're insured by one of two companies, either Employers of Warsaw, who was at the time Alabama Medical Association state-sponsored carrier, or you were insured by St. Paul. And in the spring of 1975, you received a letter. And if you were an Employees of Warsaw insured, your letter said, we're abandoning the Alabama market, but your coverage will expire in the next couple of months. If you were a St. Paul insured, you got a letter that said, you know, we're going to continue to write professional liability for physicians in Alabama, but we're not going to be in the position to add a partner or to add an employee or to take any new insurance. So literally overnight in Alabama, the market for professional liability health care providers disappeared. It evaporated. Physicians in Alabama banded together at that time and sought alternatives. They sought domestic alternatives. They sought international alternatives. And nobody would step to the table. So that group of physicians banded together, borrowed $5 million, and started what is today ProAssurance, with a shareholder's equity of well north of $1 billion. And what did they do then that made that enterprise so different than the enterprises that have come before, and if many that have come since. They did a couple of things very, very different. The sort of modus operandi of the commercial companies back in the 70s and before that had been to settle every case that came along. They didn't write a premium that could withstand the risk of a trial, and the long-tail business had a very deleterious impact on the financial position. So the commercial carriers settled cases. Those physicians in Alabama that started what is now ProAssurance said, we will not settle cases that are not cases of liability. That was very, very important for reasons that I'll come back to in a minute. The second thing that group of physicians said is, we never again want to put physicians in Alabama in a position where somebody can literally overnight affect their ability to practice medicine by withdrawing the insurance coverage. So one of the two tenets upon which the company was started was the basis that we're going to have a financial statement that is second to none. Those physicians in Alabama recognize that when you write a long-tail business, you put a price on your product years before you know what that product will cost you. And that's very important in our business. And we do the same thing today they did then. We have to put a price on the business years before we know what the cost will be. Now, there's a great temptation there. The temptation is to bring in as much premium as you possibly can and hope the investment portfolios and other things work out so as to enable you to comply with the promise and to meet the promise you made to those policyholders when you accepted their premium several years before. So those were the two things. It started the company in 1975, issued the first policy in 1977, and all these years later are considerably larger, considerably successful, but yet still adhering to those two tenets. Now, the financial part of it, the need for a balance sheet strength, is critical. The landscape of professional liability insurers in this country is littered with the corpses of those companies which could not meet the promise to the shareholders. They could not meet the obligations of long-tail insurance and therefore failed. So you can't give in to the temptation to cash flow underwriting. You can't seek just to aggregate as much premium as possible and hope things will work out for you 4, 5, or 6 years later. And the company remains very devoted to that today, as you see from the financial information Ned just shared with you. The second thing the company remains very devoted to is this notion that we will not settle a case that is not a case of liability. We want to very quickly settle those cases in which the physician breached the standard of care, causing injury or death to his patient. And we want to settle those cases for an amount which the law requires. And we want to do it as quickly as we possibly can. But those cases which do not involve a breach of the standard of care, those cases in which the physician did not cause the injury or death, are not cases of liability in any state. And we believe very strongly that those cases should be defended. And they should be defended for a lot of reasons. One, the law says they're not cases of liability, no indemnity dollars are owed. But more importantly for our customer, for the physician, the case should be defended. Because you know every time you pay a penny in a professional liability case that is not a case of liability, you diminish that physician. And again, there's a temptation there for the insurance carrier to pay the money and settle the case, because the insurance carrier gets to close its file. The plaintiff's lawyer gets to close his or her file. The defense lawyer gets to close that file. So all the files are closed except one. The physician never gets to close that file. On every application for hospital privileges he ever completes, on every application for professional liability coverage he ever files, he will have to disclose the fact of that settlement. And if it wasn't a case of liability, if the money should not have been paid, then he suffers for that for the rest of his professional life. And it and the consequences of an unnecessary settlement remain with him forever. When a physician settles a case in many states, she has to report it to the state, and it becomes a matter of public record. And that's increasing as the health care debate rages in this country. And so if you're in one of the 17 states that currently requires that, and the federal government may soon require it with its National Practitioners Data Bank, then your patients can go online and see exactly what your professional liability experience has been. Now, if you're referred to an orthopedic surgeon and you look online and you see that Dr. Jones has had three settlements, what's the average consumer going to conclude from that? And how ready is the average consumer going to be to go to that physician to seek health care? Now, the physician doesn't get to tell his side of that story. Well, the insurance company said I ought to settle. It was going to take a long time in court. It was going to be expensive to try. There was a risk to it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But nobody described to that physician what the real consequences of settling a case of no merit would be for the rest of his career. And, you know, physicians are not like engineers in the sense that they get to think their problem through, and they get to spend whatever time it takes to figure out the ramifications of something. Physicians are confronted every day with a condition not of their making, and they're expected to make people well. And you're going to get unfortunate outcomes in healthcare. Every patient of every physician will ultimately suffer the worst possible outcome. We all die. But that doesn't mean anybody necessarily did anything wrong. And one of the jobs of the insurance company is to make sure the physician understands that, to make certain that he or she doesn't settle cases unless they are actually cases of liability. And if it's a big question as to whether they're a case of liability, then you have to evaluate all of those separately. But this notion of just settling cases in order to close the file is the equivalent of feeding a tiger in hope that he eats you last, because sooner or later, it will catch up to you. And sooner or later, the consequences of what you're doing will be known. So far as I know, we're the only company in the country that will tell you the number of cases we tried last year. And we'll tell you the number we tried the year before that and the year before that and on back. Now, lots of companies will tell you their win percentage, but that's meaningless. If I try 10 cases and win 80 of them, that's an 80% win rate. But if I settle 2,000, what have I done? So unless you know the number you're actually trying as opposed to some percentage win rate, you don't really know whether the company is defending the cases. And it is not easy to defend cases because there is a risk to every trial. And you have to price your premium to accept that risk and to take that risk. And the physician has to understand that. But you also make certain that the physician understands the other side of the coin, and many lawyers and companies don't. That is, if you settle this case and it's not a case of liability, it's going to be with you forever and ever and ever. Very important. And of course, the other thing that's important is the financial strength. So if the company loses the case that's tried, the company can pay the verdict in accordance with the policy. You know, every insurance policy is just a piece of paper. We pay a premium, you pay a premium, we give you that piece of paper. And in the medical malpractice world, that piece of paper counts for something on 2 days. One, the day they assign you a lawyer who's going to defend you. And the other is the day the jury comes back with a verdict against you. Are they going to assign you a lawyer who really understands what he or she is doing and is able to bring all of his or her talents to bear in defending that physician? Or is the insurance company going to tie the lawyer's hands behind her by giving her practice guidelines and all these other things that are designed to reduce the cost of the defense? And then when the verdict comes back, can the company pay it? This policy, this promise that it made 4 or 5 years ago. Very, very important, and I'll promise you, most physicians today have forgotten or perhaps never learned the the lessons those Alabama physicians were taught in the mid-70s. And that is the importance of defending cases that are not cases of liability, because settlements have consequences. And if the physician decides he or she wants to settle a case, that's great. But that physician needs to understand the consequences of that and what it means to him or her. Also, it's important to remember the need for financial strength. You know, old sayings get to be old sayings because they're true. And the truth is, you generally get what you pay for in the world. Life teaches us that over and over again. And the company that sells you a professional liability policy for X and saves you a bunch of money may be the most expensive insurance policy you ever bought. If it's not going to be around to provide you with the defense you deserve, and if it's not going to be around to pay the claim. So we spend lots of times with our customers trying to help them to discern the difference. And pricing matters when you're comparing apples to apples. And people should obviously be free to buy whatever product they want to buy, but they need to understand what the product actually provides when they buy it. Now, all of this, this discernment, as we talk about it, we try to capture under the slogan, which you'll always see every time you see the name ProAssurance. And that slogan is treated fairly. And it's much more than a slogan. It's a little awkward when you first see it. It's intended to be awkward. It's intended to help you remember it. We have a number of different constituency groups at ProAssurance: our shareholders, our policyholders, our employees, and those with whom we have reinsurance arrangements. And we want treated fairly to capitalize every relationship we have. You know, I don't like that saying, the customer's always right, because one, is not true, and two, that wouldn't be fair. But treated fairly simply means that when you walk away from every encounter with ProAssurance, you'll understand why we did what we did. If things are done right, if the process is carried out correctly, we'll all be on the same page. But at the very least, everyone with whom we have that encounter will understand why we did what we did. And if you're a physician, we expect every encounter to produce a customer for life, because that encounter ought to demonstrate to the physician what they're getting for that professional liability policy. We also expect treated fairly to characterize our relationship with our shareholders. We put our entire investment portfolio on the internet every quarter. That's fair. It's not fair that you have to wonder about what's in it. We tell you exactly what it is, and you can model it down to the CUSIP level, if you like. That's fair. And we want treated fairly to demonstrate all of that on a recurring basis over and over and over again. You know, perhaps tomorrow when you're snowed in advance of that, you may go to the grocery store. And while in the grocery store, let's just say you see me and you see your physician. When you see me, you'll think that's Stan. When you see your physician, you'll think that's Dr. Smith. A physician, more than anyone in our society, is what she does. And when you accuse her of injuring her patient or killing her patient, you've made the most serious possible charge against her. And we at ProAssurance don't treat that like another day at the office, because this is about a lot more than money. It's about a lot more than money. We've got a few minutes left, and I'm told I need to quit for questions. I know this is a little different than what you're used to with all the slides and the numbers and all that, but I'm not smart enough to do all that, and Ned does it well. What questions can I answer for you? Yes, sir.
In terms of growth opportunities, where do you see the future growth coming from? The nature of the business, geography,
maybe mergers and acquisitions? And if we're talking about mergers and acquisitions, what kind of size are we looking at in terms of acquisitions, and how these acquisitions are going to be financed?
The question has to do with future growth. If you look at that growth from that beginning I described in Alabama all those years ago, you'll see that the growth has come primarily through mergers and acquisitions. The professional liability, healthcare professional liability business is actually a different business in every state in which you're in. We're in 50 states, we're in 50 different state businesses because every state has to be evaluated differently. Every state has to be run differently because of the different systems in every state. But our growth has come through mergers and acquisitions. We had we completed the PICA transaction last year, which is the podiatry mutual company that we were with us, sponsored demutualization, and they became part of ProAssurance through that. We'll continue to be opportunistic in that regard. We will look at every M&A opportunity that comes along. All the M&A chatter sort of died for the last year or so, but it's beginning to pick back up again. As Ned said to you, we have very little debt, so those markets are open to us to finance acquisitions if the need be. We've got a good share currency that we can use to finance those acquisitions. The size, we've done in the last year, we've done things as small as $5 million. We've done things as large as $130 million, and so size is not really an issue for us. This is a very fragmented business. The average market share, well, not the average market share, but we've got about roughly 4 to 5% of the market, and we're the largest pure play publicly traded professional liability carrier in the country. There are some mutuals that are bigger than we are that are above us, and then you've got some subsidiaries of bigger organizations that write more premium than we do, but I think we're number fifth, total fourth, if total. But the largest publicly traded. So we intend to grow, we will grow, and we look forward to that. We're going to do it judiciously, and we're going to do it strategically, and trying to expand our platform as appropriate opportunities present themselves. I mean, there's some states that have lots of healthcare potential customers where we don't have a big presence. There's some states where we do have a big presence. Greg?
Mr. Starnes, could you please address tort reform? I know every quarter you're asked about this on the conference calls. When you go out and meet with investors, they're always asking about tort reform.
Right.
And it never seems to click because here I am asking the question again. Maybe in a way that you describe your business, which was, I thought, very interesting, maybe you could do the same on the tort reform side for us.
Tort reform, of course, as it has existed by and large thus far in this country, is on a state-by-state basis. And different people mean different things when they say tort reform, so the first thing you have to be careful about is what somebody means. The Plaintiffs' Trial Lawyers Association would be all in favor of tort reform if it included mandatory awards to plaintiffs, for example. That would be the sort of tort reform that they could embrace. But it's not typically what we mean when we say tort reform. The tort reform passed in some states has been declared constitutional. The tort on a statewide basis, state constitutional basis. The tort reform in others that's passed in other states has been declared unconstitutional, as the recent decision in Illinois last week illustrates. The important thing about tort reform, in my view, from a societal standpoint, is not whether we increase or decrease the amount of money that are paid out in verdicts or settlements. That's one consequence of tort reform, but it's not the real reason to have it. The real reason to have tort reform is to provide access to care. That's why we as a society need tort reform, because if physicians do not have confidence that the legal system will treat them fairly, then they're going to withdraw from providing those services. And we saw that all across the country in the 70s and 80s and on into today when obstetrical services, for example, are available in only limited geographic areas. You see that today in some parts of the country where neurosurgeons are unwilling to go into an emergency room at night. So access to care is the reason to have tort reform, to give physicians confidence that the system will treat them fairly and not simply as a pawn that's part of the game. That's the reason to have tort reform. Now, the impact of tort reform, of course, varies greatly depending on what it provides and what it means. Some people say, well, the reason frequency has gone down in our business is because we've had tort reform. But if you'll look, you'll see that frequency has gone down in states that have had no tort reform. It has gone down in states that have had tort reform. But frequency's also gone down in other areas, such as workman's comp and other sorts of claims. So I'm not sure tort reform is the real enabling force for the decline in frequency. It may have been something else. I think we need to see tort reform on the federal level. It's well established that you can save health care dollars by a good, solid tort reform program. California's had their program in place for over 30 years, and it's demonstrated an ability to provide stability to the system so that you can provide stability to premiums. But you've got to be careful about tort reform in terms of what it means and what the term actually refers to. The Democratic Congress and the Democratic administration to this point have shown no willingness to embrace what most of us would regard as real tort reform, so I'm not optimistic that we'll see it in any health care bill that comes out of Washington. Now, people ask me all the time, what's going to be the impact on your business of health care at the national level if it passes? And it actually, I don't think, has any direct impact. But what it will have a huge impact upon is the environment in which our customers do their work. And if you had to characterize that environment as portrayed in the bills that have been passed by the House and the Senate, you would say it will be an environment of limited care and unlimited liability. And that will have an impact on our business. I think for those of us that are good operators in the business, it probably helps in terms of removing the low-hanging fruit and makes it more difficult for less skilled competitors to engage in this business. The other impact it's going to have, in my judgment at least, is on frequency. Frequency, as you know, refers to the number of claims. An actuary won't use the language I'm about to use, but my sort of street view is frequency is a product of two things. That is, people make claims against physicians because of either patient frustration. They feel like they weren't treated right, that nobody respected, that nobody looked after their mama correctly. Patient frustration drives patients to lawyers. And the second thing that drives patients to lawyers are unexpected outcomes. Notice I didn't say bad outcomes, unexpected outcomes. And our expectations as a country for the outcome of our health care could not be higher, unrealistically high in many cases. So if you have unrealistic expectations for the outcome of your health care and those expectations are not met, that's going to drive people to see a lawyer. And if you have high levels of patient frustration, that's going to drive people to see a lawyer. There is nothing about any of the health care reform that has been suggested at the national level that's going to reduce unexpected outcomes. If anything, it's going to raise up the expectations because now you have 30 million people that have insurance and will have different expectations for their health care. Incidentally, 30 million people without one single new physician. Think what that's going to mean to you when you call your physician for an appointment. And there's also nothing about bureaucratized health care that's going to alleviate or reduce patient frustration. That's going through the roof. So my own view is, and this is nothing more than a prediction and is worth what you're paying for, which is nothing, is that health care reform in time will drive frequency up. My time's just about up. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
One question on policy terms and conditions. On your last conference call, you mentioned that in one particular jurisdiction, you're writing like two-year policies.
Yeah.
Kind of what's your stance on that? Is that spreading to other jurisdictions, or where do you see terms and conditions right now in the current market?
You know, terms and conditions, you get some play in terms and conditions in the soft market just like you do in premium. We haven't altered our terms and conditions by and large at all. We have made a two-year policy available in one jurisdiction, and thus far we're very, very pleased with it. And we're looking, considering, have not decided, but are considering expanding that to other jurisdictions. But we think, you know, in the right jurisdictions, I say, remember, every one of these states is a different business, and you have to run them differently. But we think there's room for a two-year policy. In those states in which we have the knowledge of the state, it makes us comfortable writing on a two-year basis. Great. Thank you very much. Enjoyed being with you.